Hi, podcast listeners. You'll be glad to hear Tony's voice back in the studio. But what's a vacation without reading a couple good books? Tony will tell you about two that he's reading. Next, Tony and I are going to offer a preliminary response to the Guidepost report about sexual abuse at the top levels in the Southern Baptist Convention. There's more to the story, and we'll have more to say, but we'll tell you what we know so far. We appreciate you supporting the show by listening, rating, reviewing, and sharing the podcast with your friends. Thanks.
All righty. Good morning, everybody. Welcome in. It's great to be back behind a microphone. I'm very grateful for Austin and Corey and Hannah and everybody else who traversed the studio while I was gone. But it's good to be back and be in the chair. So, good morning. This is Tony Beam, Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference. Of course, my co-host and the driver of the ship last week is Austin Barker.
Very nice to have you back.
I cannot discern here. I cannot control the volume of my headphones. So let's see why that's the case. Ah, because I'm turning the wrong knob. That's why. You have to turn the right knob. There's so many knobs and dials and buttons and sliders and stuff in here that if you turn the wrong one, you're just not going to get the right result.
Is that a metaphor probably, for life?
Yeah. That's a great biblical illustration. Talking about that yesterday when I talked about Pergamum at Impact Church.
Is that the same as purgatory?
No, Pergamum is a place.
Okay, so is purgatory.
Yeah, well, purgatory is not a real place. It doesn't exist, only in the minds of some. Okay, I don't want to get in trouble right off the bat, although that's probably a good thing. Just go ahead and start a war right here at the beginning of the show.
How'd your vacation go?
It was really picturesque. It was great. Camper was worked perfectly. Everything was good. They didn't get cable fixed. I mean, the cable was out when we got there. So we didn't have television until Wednesday, which actually was a good thing.
That probably made it better, didn't it?
Well, I read a couple of books over this past week, and they were just great.
Oh, wow. What'd you read?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
Well, sorry.
One of them is called The Right, which is a history of the conservative movement. It's the 100-year war for American conservatism, which is just fascinating. I mean, I love history anyway, but to understand the role William Buckley played and some of the positions that conservatism has taken and that have just been horrible,
mm-hmm.
You know, back in the beginning.
Barry Goldwater? I mean, or are we talking about before that even?
No, but way before Barry Goldwater.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, the book was fascinating, and it traces conservative thought and the offshoots, the way that conservatism held the line or attempted to in the midst of a lot of offshoots of conservatism that tried to take the banner of conservatism and run with it, and how it really conservatism didn't gain a really national popular following until the advent of Reagan, and then I haven't finished what I did is one day I would read one book and one day I would read the other, so I've got about two-thirds of the way through both. Is what it ended up.
Do you trust the author? I mean, was the author? Did you feel like the author was making credible points?
Yes, absolutely. Pull this up here. Matthew Continetti is the author, and the thing I like about it is it was true to history. It traced the historical moments that gave birth to conservative responses to historical events, and then how that coalesced into a movement. And then he talked about the tenets of conservatism and how they were formed. And so he went beyond just the historical events and conservative thought's response, but also to how conservatism was developed over the years by the – and it's just writer after writer after writer – you know, so many that I'd forgotten about, that and examples of their work and how their thought influenced conservatism for a time. It's just a great book.
And
I've really enjoyed it.
And at the end of it, you might have a better understanding of why Donald Trump has captured the minds of conservatives now.
Well, there's always been a Donald Trump. He's just we've never he hasn't there hasn't been the instant platform for his thought. But Donald Trump has marched through the ages in conservatism.
So, wow, that's something.
Well, yeah.
So I mean, Donald Trump's not anomalous for conservatives.
Not really. The anomalous part is the way that Trump is able to capture national attention through Twitter and the 24-hour news cycle, and the fact that the news media was fascinated in covering him. But there's always been populism, and populism has had different expressions by different people that have been successful to one degree or another. Some of populism's ideas have been embraced by conservatism, and others rejected. And so it's, again, it gives you a kind of a better view of how Donald Trump was able to capture American thinking.
Call it flash mob conservatism in that sense?
No, I mean I don't know what flash mob conservatism is. I would say that Donald Trump showed up at a particular moment in history where the door was wide open for his brand of populism because of the frustration that a lot of people had with conservatism. Conservatism, oddly enough, by not being aggressive enough in pushing its own ideas politically and implementing them nationally, opened the door for someone who really took conservatism and turned it into something else. So it's interesting in that point. But anyway, it's a good book. So the other one is This Will Not Pass. Now, This would be controversial for people who would say, "Well, why are you reading that book?" I mean, that's written by two New York Times authors, writers, and it goes in depth into the January 6th incident. But at the same time that it talks about and we talked about this on the show, you know, when you have Kevin McCarthy come out and say, look, I absolutely didn't say that I was going to ask Trump about resigning. And then a recording shows up where Kevin McCarthy is on a telephone call saying, I'm going to ask the president to resign. That's pretty big news. And this book is where that recording, doing the research for this book, is where that recording emerged. And so, you know, they published the book, and then McCarthy denies it, and they said, well, go to the tape. Here, roll the tape. Here's the tape. And so that was an embarrassing moment for this, you know, the minority leader. But, you know, he got a standing ovation from by the House, Republicans in the House, by most Republicans, when he came clean about it. So it hasn't really hurt him politically yet. Don't know that it will. But in any event, this book goes beyond Trump into the Biden administration and talks about, you know, how Kamala Harris got to be VP. It goes into detail about the vetting process and who all was considered to be vice president and why they landed on Kamala Harris. And there were a lot of candidates that were much more qualified and much more highly regarded than Kamala Harris. But the overriding question was, who can get added to the ticket that will immediately give us a boost to beat Donald Trump? Since the whole Biden persona was created by the Democrat Party to beat Donald Trump. Biden was pushed by the Democrat Party when they realized that, you know, Bernie Sanders might actually get the nomination. They had to come up with an alternative that was more palatable to the people that they were going to need to vote for Biden in order for him to get elected. And so they pretty much just manufactured this entire Biden, Harris ticket and turned it into something that to the American people that it never was. And then the problem, one of the reasons the problem started almost immediately after Biden took office was because the whole presentation of who Biden and Harris were was pretty much, I mean, there were some nods to the left in order to get them to stay on board, but that was primarily to convince them that it was okay to vote for this team because they actually were going to govern as leftist. Well, when Biden shows up, he runs as good old Joe and shows up as Stalin light, then that becomes a problem for a lot of Americans because that's not what they thought they were signing up for. And so the creation of Harris Biden might have reached the goal of gaining the presidency, but the creation of it has led to numerous problems since Biden has actually taken office. And this book goes into a lot of those and why they exist. And I haven't gotten to the part yet because it's in the final third where it talks about the real concern over Biden's mental state that exists within the Democrat Party and how those signs started showing up and how they've been exacerbated over the last year or so.
So I guess the big question that the book is asking you to answer, and I wonder if you think, can American democracy ever work again? Because it's basically saying it's broken from both sides. Do you share their sense of alarm? Because that's the alarm bell that they're ringing. Is American democracy under threat?
Not when you spend a lot of time listening to or reading history, because American democracy has been broken since it was created in terms of somebody has been saying, this is it. If this happens, democracy is over. We can't recover from this. Andrew Jackson being elected president, that was going to be the end of democracy. John Adams, I mean, let's go back a lot further than Andrew Jackson. John Adams becoming president, Thomas Jefferson was convinced that the country would never survive an Adams presidency, which is, you know, why he ran against Adams, and Adams only had one term. And so, you know, you've always the Federalists that you've and the gap between political parties has been wide since day one. And so, you know, this idea that we uniquely are living in a time when we're never going to be able to put things back together politically, if you become a student of history, you'll feel a lot better about that. You'll see that, yes, things the difference this time is the undergirding morality that has always kind of kept everybody focused and feeling that the country's not falling apart is being removed. I mean, you can handle two political parties that are at odds with each other and at a stalemate, but can you handle that along with the idea that women can be men and men can be women? Can you handle that along with the idea that a baby should be aborted right up to the point where his head is popping out in the delivery room? Should you? I mean, when once you rip away the moral fabric of the broader discussions of political life, then the panic sets in because you just feel like there's nothing out there that's normal. And so everybody thinks this is it. I don't necessarily think politically this is it. It may be it for the stock market. You know, that may be it for me. But I knew that the second shoe at the Southern Baptist Convention was going to drop yesterday. And I knew that the news was not going to be particularly good. I don't know. I knew how bad it was going to be. I don't think anybody guessed that Guidepost Report would run 288 pages. Now, some of you're going, what are you talking about? Because you don't follow Southern Baptist life. And, if you're not Southern Baptist, I get that. Other than the fact that Southern Baptist is the largest Protestant denomination, and it's also the most conservative. So in terms of influence in the culture for good, the convention, the Southern Baptist, have brought a good influence to the culture morally, but that moral influence has been called into question by this task force report from Guidepost that was released yesterday. Now, it came out at 4 o'clock, and I was still involved. Some of you may have seen me on Fox 21 last night. I had a couple of people that, one a member at Impact Church in Spartanburg, another visiting with her because he was dating her. But they're octogenarians. They're in their 80s, and they got married yesterday. And it was a cool story because it turns out Harold is, saw Marie, who's the member at Impact. Harold saw Marie at church. She was singing in the choir, and he was very taken by her, and they started dating. And then he went off in the military, and they broke up, and hadn't seen each other in 62 years until they were both in the same retirement center, and she stepped off of an elevator, and there he was, and apparently on the floor where she was getting off. And they, you know, the first thing she said to him when she recognized him was, "I thought you were dead." So, you know, these are people. I know Marie has had two husbands that passed away. And I know Harold had a wife who passed away, maybe just one. I'm not sure about that part of the story. But that was a sort of a reunion for them, and they started dating, and that turned into them getting married yesterday. And I performed the ceremony at the retirement center where in Malden, where they met.
And got famous for doing so, apparently.
Well, that famous. I was on Fox 21 last night, 10 o'clock news. It was the last story, which most people are in bed by then. But it was, you know, I had a little blurb on there because it showed me marrying them. And the only fame is the fact that I happen to know both of them. They asked me to do the ceremony. But it's a story that Fox 21 has really bought into. So anyway, I was wrapped up with all that yesterday afternoon, so I didn't get to see the report when it dropped. I did read the AP story, which of course is going to sensationalize some of the more gritty parts of the report. But it's 288 pages. So I sat down last night. I went to the gym, did some other things, didn't get home till about 8 o'clock. So I started reading and I read about 70 pages. So before I do a lot of commenting about it, I want to get all the way through the report. But let's just say that it sheds dark light on Southern Baptist, the executive committee of the Southern Baptist Convention. And for those of you who don't know how it works, the Southern Baptist Convention is unique in that it is not a hierarchical system where you have a central power that governs the actions of churches. And this happens, of course, in the Presbyterian Church. It happens in the United Methodist Church. It happens in just about every denomination has a central office or group that make decisions for the churches and then hand down dictates that all the churches, if you're going to be United Methodist, where, you know, you've got to do this. If you're going to be Presbyterian, this is what Presbyterians do. Well, the Southern Baptist Convention only exists technically for 3 days in June, and then the executive committee is, and the leader of the executive committee, the head of the executive committee, is tasked with carrying out the permanent aspects of Southern Baptist life, which includes six seminaries, the International Mission Board, the North American Mission Board. As you would imagine, North American Mission Board handles missionaries that are in the North American sphere. International Mission Board is everywhere else. So, and then the seminaries, and then a couple of there are national camps that the Southern Baptist Convention owns. And what else?
Relief organization.
Well, then there's the retirement. There's Guidestone, which is not to be confused with Guidepost. Guidepost is the organization that did this investigation in the Executive Council. Guidestone is the retirement entity, the investment entity that invests all the retirement income of most pastors and, you know, that are part of the Guidestone retirement system. So in any event, there's no, like, if when people would contact the Southern Baptist Convention Executive Committee and say, "I know of sexual abuse going on at First Baptist Church Podunk in South Alabama." And, you know, I'm just making stuff up here, of course. And then the Executive Committee was like, "Well, you're going to have to deal with it, because whether you're a survivor or you're whatever, you're reporting something for a survivor," which is now the terminology, of course, that's used for people that are victims of sexual abuse, then that has to be dealt with on the local level. We don't step in and tell churches what they can or can't do or have to do. We don't have that authority. That's not how, you know, the convention is built on church autonomy. So you know, the only method we have of disciplining a church that doesn't conform to Southern Baptist teaching is to say, we're going to send back your cooperative program dollars. You know, that church cooperates. The cooperative program is the vehicle that sort of funds the seminaries, it funds the International Mission Board, the North American, all the other entities that I talked about, and it pays the salaries of the executive committee that sort of administrates, and of course, Lifeway, I forgot, you know, Lifeway Publications, which publishes all the small group material for the Southern Baptist Convention. It used to be Sunday School, and now it's, you know, it does not call that. It used to be called the Sunday School Board for a while, but now it's Lifeway. It used to be bookstores all over the country. Of course, they've all closed, and the only place you can buy stuff now, we don't have brick-and-mortar stores anymore. Lifeway is totally online. So anyway, all of that has to be funded, and the cooperative program is the vehicle that does that. People give to the local church, and the church forwards on a percentage of what the church receives in tithes and offerings to the Southern Baptist Convention. As a member, as a cooperating member. So if the, like First Baptist Greenville, I think still goes by that name, but it's no longer a Southern Baptist church because a long time ago, the Southern Baptist Convention said, well, you know, you're marrying gays, you're bringing, you know, doing all kinds of things that are opposed to Scripture and teaching of the Bible and that disagree with Southern Baptist teaching. So we're going to return your cooperative program dollars, and we're going to withdraw fellowship from you. So that's the only thing. So, and withdrawing fellowship is not necessarily an effective tool in fighting sexual abuse on the local church level. So the report actually, though, goes into this, that after a while, there were people at the executive committee level that started keeping a list of pastors and youth ministers and volunteers and deacons in Baptist churches who had been convicted or credibly accused of sexual abuse. And there's a list of them, but nothing was ever done with it. It wasn't published. It was there, but there was nothing. Nobody could access it. And so, therefore, Southern Baptists were allowing, in this report, the allegation is that Southern Baptists were allowing these ministers to move from one church to the other, similar to the way the Catholic Church were moving priests around and different people who were accused of sexual abuse, instead of somehow dealing with it. But in the Southern Baptist Convention Executive Council's defense, and there are those who would say there is no defense, and I get that. When you read the depth of this, and I mean, Johnny Hunt's name has come out. Johnny Hunt was he's a pillar in Southern Baptist life. He was president of the convention. He was a leader. He was at the North American Mission Board currently. He pastored one of the largest churches in the convention in Georgia. But an influential evangelist and just a writer, and he's preached in so many places around the world. And it turns out that there's a credible story about an assault that he had against another pastor's wife while they were on vacation back in 2010. And this came out as part of this report. And, you know, Johnny Hunt has admitted to some inappropriate behavior, but denies some of the worst parts of the report. And Guidepost stands by it and says that his denials are not credible. So it depends on, you know, who you believe and what you believe. And, of course, you know, you get back to Paige Patterson, who left Southwestern Seminary under a cloud. And, you know, he basically refused to cooperate with the committee, didn't give them access to his presidential library. He had his lawyers go through all these reams of paper that was generated when he was president of Southwestern, and only sent about 2 pages of information to the Guidepost Committee. So, you know, and then high-profile leaders like Jack Graham, who was a pastor in Texas for a large church and was, I think, one of the people that were kind of in Trump's circle of pastors and leaders that were advising him and ministering to him, Jack Graham refused to be interviewed. He said, "You can look at my presidential papers, anything that I've got," but and because he was president of the convention at one time, and God Post said, "Well, thank you, but we've already got access to all that. We just want to sit down and talk to you." And he never responded. I mean, he just said no, or he didn't say no. He just didn't say anything. Paul Pressler, who was involved for years, Judge Pressler out of Texas. Mainly Pressler and Patterson were the architects of the conservative resurgence in the Southern Baptist Convention that began in the late 70s, culminated in the mid 80s with sort of the convention going back to its conservative roots after it was drifting to the left, pretty much like other mainline denominations. Southern Baptists were among the few that were able to shift back, and it was because Pressler and Patterson realized that the key to that was the presidents of the convention, because they appointed the committee on committees that appoints all the committee members and the board members, and you get conservative trustees in these places, and you move the convention slowly back to its roots. And that happened.
And they pulled it off.
Yeah, they did. They pulled it off. It was incredible. But then, you know, we from 2001, this report goes from 2001 to 2021. So it's 21 years of looking at people coming to the executive committee and saying, you know, I've been sexually abused in a Southern Baptist church. I need help.
And they basically said there's nothing here for you.
There's not anything we can do, and in some cases go away and stop talking to us. And so that's part of the thing that Guidepost says they were treated badly. You asked me a question about, you said I was sitting that the executive committee, this is not really a defense, but what is it?
You started
in
the sentence.
In the executive committee's defense.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, I agree with Dr. Moeller, okay? Dr. Moeller addressed this. I mean, it's pretty amazing. You know, here it is. I'm on the way to do the show, and already his program
he's something, isn't he?
Yeah, is addressing, at least talking about this coming out of the blocks, which meant it was released at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. That means he read some portion of it or some accounts of it and then initially commented on it, which his show had to have been recorded last evening.
Crazy.
You know, the whole thing. So that was pretty amazing. But, you know, when I say in their defense, I was going to say I agree with Dr. Moeller. Let me get back. My train of thought gets lost here. You know, he started out by talking about Isaiah 37, verse 1. And I think he's exactly right, because the question is, what should our first response be mm-hmm. to all of this? And Isaiah 37, verse 1 says, "As soon as King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Lord." That's it. Southern Baptists don't need to begin by looking at guideposts and trying to pick apart this report. Try to offer shallow defenses for indefensible behavior. Or any of that. What needs to happen is sackcloth and ashes and mourning and weeping over the sinful nature of what has transpired here, and then go into the house of the Lord for repentance, for restoration, and to seek wisdom and guidance in how to make things right, how to come out of this and make sure that nothing like this happens again and that it stops happening in Southern Baptist churches to the extent that we have the ability to stop it.
Obviously, there are some who would delight to see the Southern Baptist Convention lose its cultural influence. Can the convention survive this report?
Sure. I mean, you know, can it?
With moral credibility?
Well, sure. All things are possible. I mean, look, in a moment of crisis, when something like this happens with a group of people, the question is, what do you do about it? And if the answer is Isaiah 37:1, then there's a possibility for all of that to happen. Restoration, forgiveness, cleansing, all of those things.
In the goodness of the Lord.
Yes.
He can superintend this affair.
Of course. Mm-hmm. But the danger is when you respond with, you know, well, you know, who are these people? Who is this guidepost? And why? Who are they to sit in judgment over us? you know, that kind of thing, that kind of attitude, or we're not going to accept this because
they had it in for the convention,
right? Or they, you know, they had an axe to grind. These people that were interviewed by Guidepost had an axe to grind for years, and they finally found somebody that would listen to their axe grinding. And I mean, if that is the attitude that we begin with, then no, the chances of a fracture and the end of the moral influence of the Southern Baptist Convention is a real possibility. But if we go the other way, which is what I pray is going to happen, and we take it's 288 pages. I mean, how can you can't do everything that they say, or respond to every part. They did. They conducted, I think it was 317 individual interviews and went through 5 terabytes of documents. Terabytes. I mean, I don't even, you know, that amount of information boggles the mind, but they were able to upload all this information into a database that made it searchable by words and phrases and all of this so that they could manage the information that was coming to them. And they, you know, they had a website where people could go and upload information, and they had to sort through that to find out what was credible and what was not credible. And they went and they spent time interviewing executive committee members. A lot of them refused to be interviewed, for the report. And
because of the possibility of personal liability?
I don't know.
It was because of the revocation of the lawyer-client privilege.
I'm on page 70. Well, they, yeah. In a very controversial standoff, you know, the executive committee at the beginning said, we're not going to waive client privilege, lawyer privilege, which means that the law firm, the internal counsel and external counsel that was giving the convention, the executive committee advice, could not be consulted. And if you can't talk to them,
confidentially.
Yeah. Well, you can't, they can't say anything. They would just say attorney-client privilege. So the only person that can waive attorney-client privilege is the client. So they had to vote to waive privilege so that counsel from these attorneys to the EC could be brought to light. What did they tell them? And that goes back to this statement in defense, because I don't really mean that I'm offering and saying nothing happened or nothing was wrong. I'm just saying that the people that were leading the executive council when this began were told by internal and external counsel, there's, by the structure of the convention, there's nothing you can do. And so these guys are preachers. They're not lawyers. I mean, that's why you hire lawyers when you're a preacher, you know. But then the question becomes, do you listen to the lawyer when a moral question supersedes the advice that you're getting?
That's such a great way of putting it.
Well, and that's, that's the main question here.
Because the lawyer is giving you good legal advice, but he's not giving you good moral advice.
Not necessarily.
Right.
Right. I mean, sometimes those things,
the right thing to do might not be good for the convention.
It could cause problems, but what causes deeper problems is when you make a decision to go against what is morally right, which would be to do something in light of all these reports that were coming to the executive committee. Now, they weren't saying, they did, like I said, I'm on page 70. I keep saying that because 288 pages to get through here. But evidently, they were not very kind with some of the accusers and some of the survivors. You know, they were dismissive, sometimes hostile toward their push for something more to be done. And
without
saying
that what they did was, without defending them, you know, the outcome of their actions, let's put them in their context and say, this was all prior to Me Too. We're post Me Too. And so it's easy for us to retrofit Me Too onto something
back onto it. 2004. Before.
Yes.
And 2000. But again.
Again.
Me Too shouldn't have had to happen for Christians
to do the right thing,
mm-hmm. in terms of what the Scripture says about what you do about a moral failure. So there we are. And this is all going to get hashed out at Anaheim in the light of it. I wish Ed Litton had not said that he was not going to serve for another term because that
that's
has opened
up.
Well, that's opened up the door for, you know, an all-out assault on the president, you know, people trying to gain the presidency. Normally, if somebody gets elected, they get another term. Now, that's not automatic.
Right.
Somebody runs, somebody could run against him, and they probably would have in the environment that we're in.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of entities are getting dragged into this along with the executive committee. Of the other entities of the convention, you know, Johnny Hunt was serving at the North American Mission Board, and he's had to resign. He resigned his position over this, and so and of course he had to because even at the minimum of inappropriate behavior, you don't have someone serving in a position of leadership at the North American Mission Board who admits to that, whether it's deeper than that or not. You know, you just have to read the report and come up with your own conclusions. Here's the motion that created the task force, and it's I may amend some of it because it's rather lengthy. I move that this came at the convention in Nashville, Southern Baptist Convention meeting in Nashville, back last year, 2021, in June. I move that the Southern Baptist Convention meeting June 15, 16, 2021 in Nashville, Tennessee, asked the newly elected president of the SBC to appoint a task force within 30 days of the date of this convention that shall be comprised of members of Baptist churches cooperating with this convention and experts in sexual abuse and the handling of sexual abuse-related dynamics. This task force shall either assume oversight of the third-party review announced previously by the executive committee or initiate a separate third-party review. So the executive committee had already said, look, we're going to have a third-party review because we can't investigate ourselves. Well, this motion went further than that because they said, well, even if the executive committee gets a third party, if they're the ones that go out and get the third party, then they're investigating themselves still. So they put this committee together that became the Sexual Abuse Task Force that selected guideposts that did the seven-month investigation. And guideposts was brought on to make sure that within 30 days, because the motion says that the report has to be given to the executive committee 30 days before the convention meeting in 2022. So it actually came out.
So they gave them a year deadline.
And they gave them, you know, the guidepost released it to the committee before it was released.
The task force had 10 days to look at the report it was released publicly.
Right. Which is why we're talking about it now, and we're under a month. The Southern Baptist Convention meets in Anaheim coming up in June. So, in any event, this started the ball rolling.
So the task force is tasked with taking action based on guidepost report.
Well, they can't take action. They can bring recommendations to the convention, and then we'll have to vote on them. Now, what I think will happen, guidepost has a list of recommendations that they're saying that the convention should take, and
Some of those will be challenges. 7 to 10 things?
Yeah, 7 to 10 things. Mm-hmm. And there'll be challenges to that probably, but I suspect that in the end, all or most or in some unaltered form, maybe slightly altered, I don't know, but I think they'll be adopted. And that's if we take the sackcloth and ashes approach.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting to see how people are writing about this, you know, Baptist bloggers.
We know how certain people are going to be writing. They're going to be trying to take the SBC down.
Of course.
Around this.
Associated Press highlighted Johnny Hunt's incident and, you know, the number of interviews and, you know, the headline was Executive Committee Covers Up Sexual Abuse. I mean, it's presenting it in the worst possible light.
And the frustrating thing about that is that that's just then slathered across the entire convention as though this is what defines Southern Baptist. If you're Southern Baptist, you're a predator.
Well, and look, a lot of the blame here has to rest with the local church, because if you have a deacon or a minister, not so much a deacon, but or a volunteer, well, it could be. But if they're credibly accused of sexual abuse and the action doesn't involve the police or even if it does, let's say that they're charged with criminal sexual behavior and they're sentenced they're not still in jail. They come out and they go minister in another church somewhere.
Across state lines.
Or they are credibly accused, but it's all kind of swept under, you know, the rug, and that person is dismissed, but they go get a position at another church. And Church A doesn't call up Church B and say, hey, before you hire this guy, you need to know why he left this church.
Isn't that a process failure there?
Doesn't it
stand to reason that that should happen?
Of course. But that's, again...
That's not the SBC's business.
Well, it's not according to the structure of the convention.
Right.
We have... Our churches are autonomous. And so... The whole argument is that the executive committee couldn't step in and do something about the local autonomy of these churches, the decisions they were making. But the argument against that was you're putting autonomy and the concept of the way the convention operates above people who are suffering sexual abuse.
Definitely.
And so
both of those things are true.
Exactly. You can't do that. I mean, you can't look at it and say, well, this is none of our business.
Especially not if you're already building a list with that. Yeah. You know, you have a list of people.
Right.
You
right.
know about this
that,
stuff.
That is the
to
real...
To know and to not act, that's moral culpability.
That's the real kicker here.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started reading that part, that's when my... blood kind of got icy. I thought, oh my gosh, because we've had discussions before. It's been brought up before at the convention.
We've talked about it here.
We need to have
too.
A list. We need to have a mm-hmm. you know a registry. It could be that you have to be convicted, or it could be that you have to be convicted or credibly if someone is dismissed because of sexual abuse allegations, even if it doesn't go to trial, they get on the list.
Help me imagine a world in which a church goes to hire somebody and doesn't do due diligence and background checks and calling previous church affiliations. And imagine
they do. I'm sure they do.
How do you not
because
find out about
church,
stuff?
Because
then?
The church doesn't tell them. They operate. Some churches operate around this idea that, well, that was a sin, but they've confessed their sin and they've been forgiven, and God gives second chances to people. You know, part of that, and part of it is I don't want to get sued because you know, a local church is the same thing. They're saying if we blackball this guy and give him a bad recommendation to Church B, then he can come back and say, well, there were no charges brought against me. What do you mean? You know, so all of that plays into decisions that are made about these things. And so the question is, all this has happened. Now what do we do about it? And Guidepost has ideas about that, and I'm sure Southern Baptist convention goers are going to have ideas about it. And all that's going to be expressed between now and Anaheim, and will be expressed on the floor. And, I mean, it's cleanup on aisle 9 is an understatement.
Oh, wow.
This would be, you know, it's going to be a big cleanup job.